From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Long ago, cats and dogs were wild. They were wolves or wildcats. Slowly, we brought them into the loving our arms of our civilization. Cats were honored in ancient Egypt, dogs buried in Roman cemeteries. These days, it is a dog's life. We're writing pets into our wills, paying for expensive kidney transplants, even sending them to daycare. Well, now there's a push to give them legal rights, even grant them status as people. This hour on Point, are pets ourselves our equals? You can join us on air or online. Do you consider your pet a member of the family? Do you see yourself as a pet parent or more like a pet owner? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is David Grimm. He's deputy news editor at Science Magazine and author of the new book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. David, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Your book had me gasping in shock and laughing out loud at times. I'd like to start off by our discussion by playing you this from the fabulous movie Best in Show.
It's not in here. It's not in here.
It should be in the crate.
It's not in the crate. I just told you that.
God, Hamilton, if she doesn't get a door, she's going to flip out.
It's not in here. You left it at the hotel. You go back and you get her busy bee. Go to the hotel and get busy bee. Run! Run! Go! Mommy's getting your toy. Don't you worry.
Well, we take our relationships with our pets quite seriously these days, even referring to ourselves as their mommies and daddies. How did we first start hanging out with cats and dogs?
Well, dogs have been with us for the longest. They're the first animal we ever domesticated. That's a little bit of controversy about when that happened, but probably somewhere between 15 and 30,000 years ago. So dogs have been with us for a long, long time. Cats, probably about 10,000 years ago. So at least a few thousand years less than dogs. And at first, you know, these animals weren't really pets. They were really almost like co-workers. Dogs helped us hunt. Cats protected our grains from mice. And so they really weren't seen as pets or even companions. They were really just co-workers, really. And then what you see is over time, a closer and closer relationship begins to develop. As you mentioned, cats were deified in ancient Egypt, and the ancient Romans considered their dogs like children. They even buried them in human cemeteries. In the Middle Ages, things got pretty dark for cats and dogs, where cats were linked with Satan, which led to their near extermination in medieval Europe, and dogs were considered spreaders of filth and disease, and they became the subject of some pretty gruesome vivisection experiments. But over the last century and a half, they've really become embraced again as companions, and really in the last couple decades as full-fledged family members.
It's clear how this evolution to coming into our hearts and homes benefited the dogs. Now they get vegan, fat-free, gluten-free food. But how did it benefit humans originally?
Well, humans, there's some interesting speculation about that. Humans obviously didn't have time for a pet 20, 30,000 years ago. We were talking about people that were in small groups, small bands, you know, wandering across the landscape. And they were just fighting for their survival. And so when the dog came on the scene, they said, you know, we've got this great new tool. This is an animal that can help us hunt, that can guard our campsite at night, and it can be really valuable. But again, they're really seeing the dog as a tool at that point, and not really even as a friend or a companion.
When we posted questions about this online, we got a flood of responses. People love to talk and write about their pets. Mary McAvenia says that when we love and care for dogs and cats, they reciprocate in kind. That's their enduring appeal. So I'm curious, people think they can actually read their pets' minds. Is there any scientific evidence that dogs and cats have human emotional responses? Like, do they feel guilty when they eat the cake?
So there's been this explosion, especially in dog cognition research over the last 15 years, ever since 1998, when a couple of groups of researchers showed that dogs could follow a human pointing gesture, which really seems kind of like a simple gesture, but it's something that chimpanzees can't do. If we point at a cup and say, hey, there's a treat in there, chimpanzees have no idea what we're talking about. But dogs get it. And as soon as researchers start showing that, there's just been this explosion, people studying the dog's mind, showing that they're capable of love, of empathy, even potentially jealousy, that they have some very demanding, they're able to have some very demanding types of memory. They may be even capable of a what's called a theory of mind, which is a sort of a sense of what we're even thinking, what their owners are thinking. And the unfortunate thing about cats, as any cat owner knows, is cats are incredibly hard to study. Try putting a cat in a laboratory. One person I interviewed for the book works with fish, and he tried one experiment on cats, and he said the fish were easier to work with than the cats were.
Wow.
So I think the cats are capable just as much as dogs are. In fact, the one experiment that had been done with a pointing showed that cats could follow pointing just as well as dogs do, which means they may also be capable of this theory of mind that even chimpanzees don't seem to be capable of.
They have human emotional responses than chimpanzees? We think of
not necessarily emotional responses, but just this idea that they are sort of tuned into us, that they sort of know what we're thinking, in a sense that when we point to something, we're trying to show them something or we're trying to teach them something, which is something children start to learn at about 1 year of age. So this is a very important skill for our species, and what was once considered very rare in the animal kingdom. And when researchers saw that chimpanzees couldn't do it, at least with a pointing, they said, wow, this is so unique that only humans must be able to do it. And then Brian Hare and Adam McClosey, two researchers, showed that dogs could do it. And it's like, oh my gosh, how can dogs do this and chimpanzees can't do it? So that's necessarily an emotional response, but it is showing some complex thinking that we didn't think that pets were capable of.
One of my favorite stories from the book is you cite a poll and you say more than half of owners said that if they were trapped on a desert island, they would choose a pet rather than a person to live out their last days. Why do we value our pets so much?
Well, I think what's really fascinating about that poll is it just shows just where we are as a society. It used to be that the person that called themselves their cats or dogs mommy or daddy, as you played in that clip from Best in Show, when the guy is calling is referring to the woman as mommy, that used to be considered pretty fringe behavior. Like, oh my God, that's the crazy cat lady, or that's the crazy dog person. And then you have these polls coming out which says, you know, that 50% of owners would rather live out their days with a dog or a cat than a human companion, and as many as 85% of owners would be somewhat or very likely to risk their lives for their pet. So what's really interesting about these polls is that they're showing that this is not just the fringe people. It's where we are as a society, that we really are viewing these animals as family members and in some cases furry children.
That's something we see reflected from almost everyone who's writing in. Jennifer Schumacher writes that my dog and cats are my babies. I don't have human children, but that's how we were raised. Animals were always part of the family. Do you think most pet owners these days see themselves as mommy and daddy?
I think they do, and I don't have the stats in front of me, but I think I quote a poll in the book that says something like 70-80% of owners refer to themselves as their pet's mom or dad. So this is becoming a very common phenomenon, and you saw this in Hurricane Katrina, where a lot of people stayed behind. In fact, one poll suggested that 44% of the people that chose to stay behind and not evacuate their homes did so because of their cats and dogs.
And many of them died.
And so it just shows that, you know, that this is how close we're becoming to our pets, that we're willing to risk our lives for them. We're willing to sometimes risk our families' lives for them. And it's not just this fringe behavior. This is really where we are as a society.
Well, some companies have seen the financial advantages of our new relationships with our pets. Here's an ad from the pet superstore Petco.
Dear Mom.
Dear Dad.
Thanks for the belly rubs.
And the endless supply of unconditional love.
Thanks for loving me completely.
But are you caring for me completely?
Petco brings you Whole Pets, a new way to think about caring for your pet's physical, mental, social, and emotional health. It's our commitment to provide the products, services, and advice to help every pet parent become one of the great ones. Petco, where the healthy pets go.
So spend money so you can be a good pet mommy or daddy.
That's right.
Has become a big business, huh?
We spent $60 billion on our pets in 2013. Actually, in 2014, that's what is estimated that we'll spend in 2014. I think it was $55 billion in 2013. The pet industry is the seventh largest retail industry in the United States. We spend so much on our pets that we actually spend more on our pets in the United States than the economies and the gross national product of half of the world's countries. So
wow.
we're not just saying, you know, these cats and dogs are family. We're really putting our money where our mouth is.
David, we'll ask you to stand by. We're talking now to David Grimm, author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. And we're going to head into break now with a little Cat Stevens, I Love My Dog. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
I love my dog as much as I love you. You make things my dog will always come through.
We're talking this hour about our evolving emotional and legal relationships with our pets. We're talking now with David Grimm. He is author of the new book, Citizen Canine. And David, I thought we'd kick it off now with a call from Kathy. She's calling in from Las Vegas, Nevada. Hi, Kathy. What's your question?
Hi, Jessica. Actually, I'm interested in David's perspective on something. You played that clip from Best in Show with, of course, the Weimaraner that is deeply emotionally bruised and human to our clearly pretty tightly wound. I operate a behavioral and training and daycare facility called the Hydrant Club here in Las Vegas. And one of the interesting connections that I'm focusing on these days is dogs' behavior as a direct correlation to the human behavior. Dogs that are overly aggressive, overly anxious, and then looking at the other end of the leash to see from whence that behavior comes. We get some interesting Dr. Phil moments when we get to work with people to working through issues to help address the dog's behavior. But it all comes down to pack leadership. And I'd be interested in David, as you've done your research and as you put forward this book, which I'm eager to read, what you found as it relates to humans as taking the role of pack leader. Because if a human doesn't take a proper leadership role with a dog, the dog is going to act out.
Thank you, Kathy, of the Hydrant Club. David, is that a fair assessment? Can the human be the pack leader? And explain, what is a pack leader?
Well, I mean, I think it goes back to the dog's origins as wolves and wolves traveling in packs and you having an alpha wolf. And some dog behavior experts have said, you know, that dogs really do retain a lot of this biology and especially mental biology from their days as wolves, and that we need to treat them a lot like we treat wolves, that there has to be a pack leader, that we have to be very disciplinary and really sort of assert ourselves as the owner and commander. But it's not a view shared by everybody. Some other behaviorists will say, you know, dogs aren't any more like wolves and we are like chimpanzees, you know, that domestication, we've had, you know, upwards of up to 30,000 years of domestication with dogs where these animals have really transformed. I mean, compare a Cocker Spaniel or a Labrador Retriever to a wolf. I mean, there's a world of difference. And I actually went to visit some wolves at Wolf Park in Indiana, and you stand next to a wolf and it's not anything like standing next to a dog. These animals are, they don't want to be near you. They don't want to be petted. You know, they could lash out at you at any second. And they don't view you as a friend or a companion. They view you as a potential threat. So there is, I think, a world of difference between wolves and dogs. And other behaviorists will say, we really can't treat dogs like wolves. That this is a completely different type of animal, and we have to treat it in a completely different type of way. So I think it really depends on who you talk to.
Going to also what I think is the heart of her question, if I understand it correctly, if you see a depressed or upset dog, is that a reflection of bad parenting?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I write about pet custody cases and the rise of judges trying to decide what's in the best interest of a cat or a dog when placing it in a home. And the question becomes, how do you decide what's in a pet's best interest? You can't ask the cat or a dog, how would you be happiest? And one of the people I interviewed for the book said, well, you know, one thing we could do was actually, you know, kind of like people do for children is actually visit them in their respective homes, see where they're happiest. And the way you could do that with cats and dogs, you could actually measure their levels of hormones like oxytocin, which is linked to maternal bonding in animals. And maybe if they have high levels of oxytocin, they're happier in that home. Or maybe if a cat is displaying less neurotic behaviors, clawing the drapes less, itching, scratching, licking less, the cat's more comfortable in that home. So I think there is something to be said for the mental state of the animal being reflective of its where it's happiest.
Sounds like this could lead to a whole new field of work for humans, pet social workers who do home
visits. That's right.
There was a statement from somebody on Facebook, which goes to some of the legal questions you're raising. Scott Nicholson says, I have increasingly become uncomfortable with the phrases we use with pets. I own a cat. I own a dog. It doesn't sit right with me. If anything, my cats own me as much as I own them. And you write about the fact that we used to call ourselves pet owners. We're moving to describe ourselves as pet guardians. What's that about?
Well, it's really reflective of where we are, especially in the last 20 years where pets haven't really become pets. I mean, that phrase is sort of falling out of favor. We're talking about companion animals. You go to a shelter, you don't buy a cat or a dog, you adopt a cat or a dog. And now a lot of people don't refer to themselves as owners. They refer to themselves as parents or guardians. So the entire terminology around pets is changing. In fact, starting in 2000, there is something called the Guardian Campaign that started up by a group called In Defense of Animals up in Northern California. And their whole goal has been to actually get states and cities to change the language on the book and not refer to owners as owners, but refer to them as guardians. And to date, I think about 20 or so cities across the country have adopted that language. They either use guardian or they use guardian next to owner. And actually, the entire state of Rhode Island now refers to pet owners as pet guardians. So it's not just a change that's happening in our homes, but it's a change that's starting to happen in the legal system as well.
And it's a meaningful legal change, too, isn't it? Because if they're no longer property that can be owned, then it creates another category. What are they and what kind of rights do they have?
Really, and that's really one of the million-dollar questions. The actual guardian language doesn't legally change the status of animals. It's more of a nomenclature thing, and a lot of the statutes are very clear to point that out. But what you're seeing in the courts is a fuzzing of this line between pet and person, between property and person. Right now, a lot of people may not be aware of, but cats and dogs are considered property in the eyes of the law, which means essentially they're considered the same as a car or a toaster. And that's actually only a recent development that's happened in the last 100 or so years. Before that, cats and dogs weren't even considered property. They were considered so worthless that the law didn't even consider them property. They can be stolen and killed and nothing would happen to you. Then they became property, and now you're seeing this change again where owners are saying, you know, I think 1% of owners actually consider their cats and dogs property. So their owners are saying, you know, these animals aren't property. They aren't pets. I feel more like a guardian. And you're seeing judges start to do things like decide on the best interest of a cat or a dog, you know, in a custody case, or laws that allow cats and dogs to inherit money, which should not happen because money is property and cats and dogs are property and property shouldn't be able to inherit property. And it violates hundreds of years of property law. And now the vast majority of states allow pets to inherit money. You've got, you know, rescue agencies rescuing pets from natural disasters. You've got judges awarding emotional distress damages for the parents of for the owners of slain pets, which should only be available for spouses and children. So there's really this fuzzing that's really starting to happen in the legal system. It's not just happening in our home. It's really happening in the eyes of the law as well.
Let's continue this discussion with Mark Beckoff. He's joining us from Boulder, Colorado, and he's professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado Boulder. Mark is the author of Why Dogs Hump and Bees Get Depressed. provocative title. He's thought a lot about seeing animals as people, a part of what he calls, quote, minding animals. Mark Beckhoff, welcome back to On Point. What is minding animals, and what do you make of this movement toward blurring the lines between pets and people?
Thanks, Jessica. It's great to be here. Well, excuse me, minding animals refers to two things. It refers to attributing minds to other animals, you know, that they have very active and inquisitive minds and brains. And the other part is taking care of them, minding them as you would maybe mind a person in need. I think it's a great change. I agree with David. It's a lot of terminology, but language, language really informs thought, and thought informs action. And so many people say, oh, my dog or my cat is a family member, so why not refer to them as who rather than that? And why not really begin to give them increased protection in the law?
Let's take a question to open this up a little more. Ken, who is calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Ken, I think you're a dog fan.
Hi, Jessica. Thanks for taking my call, and thanks to your panel. Another great show. My dog is part of the family. She's the third of the same species. I'm a big fan of the Wheaton Terriers. I've had other terriers that we've spent thousands of dollars in vet bills. She sleeps with my kids. I have two boys, and she's a big part of our lifestyle and our family. She comes to work with me on the days that I don't have appointments at the office. But we take a very middle-of-the-road approach. I see her as a semi-sentient or sentient. She doesn't have the...
I'm sorry, we're losing you. Your phone is cutting out, Ken. But we understand the gist of your question. Thank you for calling. David, he thinks of his dogs as sentient beings. They're loving members of the family. And as you're discussing, they're also getting... inheritance in wills. We remember Leona Helmsley. She left her white Maltese more than $10 million, one right. Lucky little doggy. It's as you're saying, not only not unusual, but it's part of federal law now.
It is. It's not federal law, but it's a law it's been a law that's adopted sort of state by state. And so there was something called the Uniform Trust Act that was adopted in 2000, which states could borrow from. And a lot of states have adopted the language of that act, which basically says, and I think it's 40 plus states, it may be even more than that right now, which basically says, you know, according to trust law now, you can leave money to the care of animals, which you really You could do it before, but a lot of times judges would just strike that out, especially if relatives contested it. And now it's legal to do it. And not only is it legal to do it, but say you leave $50,000 to your dog and one of your relatives contests that and says, no, I want that $50,000. Well, if the judge is following the law, they'll either say, no, the dog is entitled to that, or actually somebody can come into court and argue on the dog's behalf. I mean, can you imagine like somebody coming into a courtroom and saying, I'm representing this dog and this dog is entitled to $50,000. And that could technically happen now.
So does it mean that the dogs are legally proactively entitled to legal counsel, or that's an open question?
Well, that's the implication of the law. I don't know if that's ever actually happened. As I talk in the book, there's actually been a few cases in the last 5 years where dogs have actually been assigned lawyers. That hasn't happened in trust cases, but it did happen in one custody case, and it happened in a pit bull case in 2012 where a pit bull in Georgia bit a small child. They were going to euthanize the pit bull, and this judge said, let's just take a step back. I'm going to give this dog a lawyer, and the lawyer will help me, will represent the dog in court and let us figure out whether we should kill this dog or maybe send it to a sanctuary. The dog was essentially on death row, had a death row lawyer, and the lawyer eventually got the dog off, and the dog's now living in a sanctuary in New York, which again is just unprecedented. You would never have a lawyer for a couch or a toaster, but now we've got a few cases where dogs have gotten lawyers. So again, it's just really gets back to this idea that it's not the crazy cat person, it's not the crazy dog person. This is really where we're going as a society.
So Devlin writes to us on Twitter, I find it insulting calling animals our children and we their parents. They're our companions and we our guardians. Mark, do you think we're losing an important distinction when we see them as members of our family?
No, I really don't. I mean, you can say that we're guardians for our children. I think it just reflects, as David writes, what's going on? I mean, you know, people say, well, the pets have become, or companion animals have become child substitutes. I'm not quite sure how to cash that out, but it reflects what's going on. And I always say that we shouldn't worry that elevating our companion animals diminishes us. I think it's just a completely separate process. But when you look at how much time and how much money and how much emotion goes into the animals with whom we share our homes, it's clear that something is radically changing. So I don't find it insulting. I think it's just reflecting where society is going.
Mark, let me press you on that because, you know, one of the things that David wrote about in his book is that pet abuse cases sometimes elicit more empathy and compassion from the general public than the stories of child abuse. That's what some prosecutors have said. And I'm wondering if there's a way in which our society is looking to pets and animals giving them all this attention and concern, and it's taking away from our compassion and attention to some of the needs of human beings who are struggling.
Yeah, I don't think so. Excuse me, I don't think so. I think compassion begets compassion. I see them as, you know, just very separate things. I think that what happens, and when I talk to a lot of my friends who, you know, they love their animals, I think what's happening is they look at them as a vulnerable class of, beings, if you will, who can't really represent themselves. And so that's the way I look at it. I think that there is this, you know, we show sympathy for a lot of human beings in need who may not be in any more need than others. So I really think it's looking at the vulnerability and the fact that we are the surrogate decision makers for the animals with whom we choose to live. I think that's huge. We make the choice to incorporate another animal into our lives.
All right, let's take a question now. Bill is calling from Northborough, Massachusetts. Bill, what's your question? Hi.
Yeah, thank you for having me follow up on that. Number one, if you have compassion goes all the way across the board. If you have compassion for people, that doesn't preclude you from having passion for animals. Mm-hmm. Compassion is a virtue that covers all living things. That's number one. Number two, animals are not things. They have feelings. They relate to us in a whole variety of ways. And whether they're cats, dogs, whether they're the snake that goes across the highway, whether they're the mole that crosses my yard, the bird that lands on my branch, the cat that's now resting on my shoulders, they have something that contributes to my life. Or the wood duck, by the way, that's now nesting in my wood duck box that's on my particular lake. They contribute something to my life that I can't even begin to describe. It's the type of thing that makes all the difference in the world in a person's life.
Thank you, Bill. Thanks for the call. David, are there demonstrated health benefits for people's close relationship with their dogs and cats?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been studies that have shown that pets lower blood pressure. They've even been shown with kids with autism or reading disabilities. All of a sudden, they'll start talking to an animal where they won't start talking to a human being. I visited a woman who has a pit bull in Baltimore that brings the pit bull to elementary schools. And you have kids there with reading disabilities, and they just can't stand up and read in front of the class or even read to their teacher. But all of a sudden, you bring the dog in, and they just start reading. The words just start flowing. So I think animals just have this really profound impact on us. You know, we talk a lot about, oh my gosh, we're spending all these money on animals, and we're putting all this attention on animals, but they're giving something back as well.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about our changing personal and legal relationships with our pets. And we're talking with David Grimm, author of the new book, Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs, and with Mark Beckhoff, professor emeritus of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Colorado, Boulder. He specializes in animal behavior. Gentlemen, I want to read you a comment from Facebook. AC writes in, "I secretly miss my dog more than my husband when I'm away on a long trip." No surprise, AC didn't use his or her full name there. And David, this gets to a question you've been touching on, that dogs are increasingly being seen as people. In AC's case, maybe literally, but I'm talking legally. What is this whole idea of recognizing dogs as a person under the law? What are the implications of that?
Well, the implications, and I'll throw in cats too. I have to say that I love dogs, but I love cats too, and I have two cats of my own, so I always have to be the advocate for cats in these conversations.
Yes.
But
understood.
But I will say that that the implications are potentially very profound, and they could be positive and they could be negative and they could be downright bizarre. On the positive side, you have cats and dogs that will be granted more protections. As Mark alluded to, now all 50 states as of a couple months ago, or maybe about a month ago, have felony anti-cruelty laws, which impose fines of up to $125,000 and 10 years in prison if you harm an animal. So that's the really good aspect of having pets have more if you want to call them rights or whatever you want to call them under the eyes of the law. But there's a lot of people that are really concerned, and as I'm sure some of the comments have come in as well, about legally changing the status of these animals. Veterinarians, for one, are terrified that you start considering your cat or a dog a child in the eyes of the court and the eyes of the law, then all of a sudden you're going to start suing them for malpractice. And it's already started to happen. Vets are starting to be sued for thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of dollars for animals that were maybe purchased for $50 because the owner says, this cat or dog is my family member, and you killed my family member, and you can't give me $50 and call it a day. This animal's worth $50,000 to my heart. And you have scientists worry that, if our feelings for our cats and dogs spill over to lab rats, that all of a sudden we're going to say, well, lab rats should be people too. And farmers concerned that, oh my gosh, cows should be people too. And what does that do to biomedical research and the agriculture industry? It's not a clean cut thing. There's a lot of opposition to this rising status of pets. It really impacts a lot of different aspects of society.
To be clear then, if they were to be granted personhood, would that legally make dogs and cats our equals under the law?
It depends. Personhood's a really fuzzy concept. When blacks were granted personhood in the mid-19th century, that did essentially put them on par with everybody else, although not quite. They weren't still embraced as citizens, and you needed the 14th, 15th Amendments, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendments for that to happen.
I think that's that would rightfully make some people
exactly,
a little uncomfortable.
Exactly, and very, very rightfully so. But again, that's what a lot of animal advocates will say is that's the only roadmap we have. We have a class of people that were once considered wild animals, and then they were co-opted in human society, and then they were considered property.
Right. It gives a legal roadmap for dogs and cats.
It does, but very, very rightfully so, offends a lot of people.
Yeah.
But it is a roadmap that some people have used. But personhood, it's unclear. I mean, I don't think anybody's arguing that cats and dogs should have the right to vote or to drive. At least not that I think. Nobody I talked to wanted that. And I talked to some pretty extreme people. What they do want is some fundamental rights, the right to be free from pain and torture, the right to be in a good home, things that we would probably grant to children, that the right that they'd get exercise and get good medical care, things like that.
Mark, we can see how quickly this conversation gets into areas that feel uncomfortable, controversial. Just the idea of granting dogs and cats legal status, does it generally diminish the meaning of what it is to be human?
I just don't think so. I think we have a very clear cut of what it means to be human. And no one I know who's supporting, say, the animal, granting animals legal rights or granting them personhood has any question about that. I always like to say, that we're exceptional and so too are other animals. But I agree with David. I can see where the fear comes. But like I said before, I don't really worry about it because I think people will see that elevating the status of these vulnerable animals doesn't decrease ash status at all. I mean, I know people say that. The other thing is it is a slippery slope, but you got to start somewhere. And if you want to get animals into the agenda, then what's a better place to start than companion animals, just like, you know, rescuing chimpanzees from invasive research. People said, oh, well, now we're going to worry about amoeba. Well, we might one day, but let's just start with the animals for whom most people feel compassion and empathy.
Nancy is calling from Monticello, Kentucky. I think that's Monticello. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Jessica. Thank you. I have an example of how dogs are not just our companions, but are our guardians. One fall day, I was walking out my front door, and my dog was on the front steps in front of me, maybe 5 feet away. And not an abnormal place for him to be, but, not normal. He'd usually be jumping up to see me and so on. So he was just sitting there, and when he saw he had my attention, he looked down and to his left very calmly, and then very calmly looked back. And he did this 3 times before I realized, well, maybe I should look where he's pointing me to. And there was a copperhead probably 3 feet away from me. If I had walked carelessly in almost any direction, it would have been very bad. And so, and it turned out to be a very pregnant copperhead. So I just wanted to say that we are not only guardians of them, they are guardians of us, albeit another species, but I will never forget that.
Thank you, Nancy. That's quite a story. Mark, you specialize in animal behavior. Can they intentionally point things out to us?
Yeah, I think so. Excuse me. I think that they form this very close relationship with us. You know, I always like to say that, people say, oh, dogs are our best friends and they're unconditional lovers. Well, they're not always our best friends and they're not always unconditional lovers. They show preferences just like we do. So, yeah, I think there are situations where the animals sense danger. It's possible they're looking to us for support, but I always like to say the plural of anecdote is data, and the story we just heard rings true to me. I've heard hundreds of them. So, yeah, I think it's very possible they prefer us as individuals, and they sense danger, and they're warning us of danger. I just don't think that that's such a highfalutin idea.
All right, so our dogs can teach us, too. Tara is calling from Manchester, Vermont. Hi.
Hi, Jessica. I have 2 thoughts on this. One is that I think that, personally, I don't think there's necessarily inherently anything wrong with people seeking companionship from their animals in this way. But I do think that there's something to be said for the human hardwiring towards connection and the fact that in a fragmented technological world where people spend a lot of their days in cubicles and in solo commutes to work, that humans are can be really deprived of connection. And so we turn to our animals for this connection. And I don't think that that in and of itself is bad, but I think that it does beg the question, why are we so deprived of connection as a human culture, at least in certain communities and parts of our civilization that have this personhood going towards animals?
Great question, Tara. The growing isolation of all of us in our modern society. David, you write about this in your book. Are pets replacing people?
Well, I mean, that's really one of the questions I get asked most often is, why is this happening now? We've lived with cats and dogs for 10,000 or more years. Why is it just in the last couple of decades that they've really gone from being pet to being bona fide family members? And I think one of the big drivers of that is technology, that, you know, we live in this world now where we all go out to dinner, but everybody stares at their iPhones and nobody talks to each other, and that we're interacting with each other over computers and mobile devices, and the level of human interaction has really gone down. And cats and dogs are just there, and they don't tune us out for a glowing screen. They don't walk out the door when we need them. They're always there for us in a way that I think people are decreasingly less available to us. And so I think they've really filled this emotional void that's been created by technology. And not that there's anything wrong with technology. I love my iPhone, but technology is missing an aspect, an emotional aspect, that pets are just there. The cat is on your lap. The dog is at your feet. And they're just there. They want to love you. They want to interact with you. They want to play with you in a way that that technology just doesn't.
Does it have to be a dog or a cat? Do you see us evolving to bring, they say pigs are very smart, loving creatures. Could we bring them into our homes increasingly?
I guess so. You know, I write in the end of the book, is it, why is it just dogs and cats? Obviously, people have other pets. Obviously, people have other pets. But in terms of the sheer number, more than half of American homes have a dog or a cat, which is five times more than have any other animal combined. So it's really dogs and cats, and in the legal system as well, they've been elevated to this status. And I think there's something special about these animals. I think they've just formed this connection with us. You know, people have tried to make ferrets catch on as pets. And potbelly pigs, but they've just never, ever caught on and probably won't ever catch on the way cats and dogs will. And I think there's just something fundamental about the way the relationship we're able to have with these animals that we're not able to have with any other animal.
Okay, let's give cats their fair due for a moment. Tim is calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I had a question. I was recently adopted by a cat, and I've been reading a lot of cat books because I'm a dog person. I don't know much about them. And one of the ones, the new ones out, is called Cat Sense. And its big theory is that cats view us as larger cats. And animals go so much by smell that I can't believe that. I can't believe that we smell anything like cats and that they would believe that we're just larger cats. What is the science or logic behind that?
Tim, thanks for your call. I have to say, I know some cat owners who smell just like cats, but I don't think that was his point. Mark,
yeah.
Let me give that one to you. Do cats view their human owners as larger cats, a member of their family?
I have the same view as Kim. I mean, it sounds good to say they do, and in fact they might, but they know we're not cats, just like our dogs know we're not dogs. I think they view us as part of their group, and maybe they may say that, you know, we're kind of a unique cat, but I actually don't think that. I think that, once again, it gets down to the social bonds that are formed and maintained. And I think one of the things that Kim said is important is, you know, a lot of people say that, oh, cats are solitary animals. You know, I know people who leave their cats alone for a week and go away and just make sure they have food and water dispensed. One of my neighbors left his cat for 4 days and came back, and the cat really shunned him for a few days. So I think we read into a lot of who these animals are.
David, I want to give you your moment to pitch for cats. You think they sort of get the short end of the stick in these conversations.
I do. And my wife and I, my wife's coined a term that she calls dogism, which is, you know, when you go into a pet store and you know, 75% of the pet store is dog products and they've got a few shelves for cats, or you go into a bookstore and it's an entire bookshelf of dog books and they've got one shelf of cats and they're lumped in with ferrets and birds and everything else, which doesn't make any sense to me because, first of all, if you just look at the raw numbers, about 36% of American homes have a dog, 30% have a cat. That there's not a big discrepancy there. I mean, you look at all other animals, they're in the single digits in terms of fish and horses and whatever. So it's really, I mean, cats and dogs really, I think cats really deserve to be on the same plane. I think a lot of owners, I think most cat owners feel just as intensely bonded to their cats as people do to their dogs. And actually, I mean, you know, selfishly, that was one of the things I wanted to do with the book, is to show that, you know, just because there's so much dog literature out there. And again, I'm a big dog person. I love dogs. If we had the space, we would definitely get a dog as well. But that it's really these two animals that are really become sort of a fundamental part of our lives.
Here's a shout out to the cats from the Disney movie Aristocats.
Naturally, I want my beloved cats to be always well cared. And certainly no one can do this better than my faithful servant, Edgar.
Edgar? Adelaide, you mean to say you're leaving a vast fortune, Edgar? Everything you possess, stocks, bonds, this mansion, your country chateau, our treasures, jewels, and...
No, George, to my cats.
To your cats?
So, David, that was in 1970 that movie came out. She was leaving her money to cats back then.
Right.
Is this the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really is the future. I mean, we already can leave money to our animals. We're leaving more and more money to our animals, and I think it's, you know, one of the things I talk about in the book is where are we going from here? Now that we're on this sort of precipice of this turning point, we've elevated cats and dogs to this really unique status that no other animal has held in all of human history. And where do we go from here? Do we keep them as pets? Are we satisfied with just treating them as companion animals? Or do we want to try to somehow make them fellow members of society? And again, I don't think that means giving them the right to vote, but do we want to protect them and care for them the same way we do for human children? And it's a very controversial issue, and it's going to be really interesting to see where we go in the next few decades. But we are really on this really dramatic trajectory, and there's no telling where it's going to end.
Mark, in the few seconds we have left, where do you see this going? More rights for dogs and cats?
Absolutely, with more and more people getting involved. I really think that there's a lot of momentum, and I really think that David did serve a great purpose by bringing cats into the
world. Here's a rah-rah for cats and dogs.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Mark Beckhoff, Professor Emeritus of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at University of Colorado Boulder. Thank you for joining us. And David Grimm, author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. We appreciate your time and loved your book.
Thank you so much, Jessica.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter or find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, new trends in eco-friendly funerals and burials, how they reflect how we are dealing with death. I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.